time to enter into our talking point this morning, and we're talking all about Palestine in today's program. The Palestine debate. The UN Security Council is due to vote on Palestine statehood very soon. They've begun their deliberations. And so this morning we're going to look at some of the background surrounding the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. And we would love to hear from you if you've got any thoughts on whether you think Australia should vote or how Australia should vote when and if it comes up in the UN General Assembly. Love to hear from you. 1-300-800-222, the text number 0437-774-774. Anthony Lowenstein is a journalist, a blogger, and is the author of a book called My Israel Question, a book all about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Very good morning, Anthony.
Thanks for having me.
No worries. Thank you for getting up and talking to us.
My pleasure. My pleasure.
Now, I've started working my way through your book. It's a pretty big one.
Yes.
But it is fascinating, I've got to say. It's certainly informed me a lot about the background to the debate and to the issues surrounding the conflict between the Palestinians and the Israelis. I'm interested by the title, though. You've called it My Israel Question. You've taken ownership, in a sense, of the problem. Why did you call it My Israel Question?
I think, in short, it's I'm Jewish, and as my name might give away, and for many, many Jewish people, for better or worse, Israel is an important part of our upbringing. I mean, for me, I was brought up in Melbourne. I'm 36. My parents, my family weren't overly pro-Israel, but certainly being critical of Israel was seen as unacceptable. It's almost as if, because of our history as Jews, because of the Holocaust and other reasons, it was, and my grandparents escaped before the Second World War and came to Australia, that being supportive of Israel and being uncritical towards Israeli policies against Palestinians was just what was done. And I started questioning that, I guess, in my teenage years and continued into my 20s and 30s. And I think ultimately, in my view, as my book talks about, and increasing numbers of Jews say that the blind support that Israel receives from the diaspora, including in Australia, in fact, is only contributing to the conflict worsening. And there is a blindness, almost a historical blindness, to what Israel is doing almost in our name. So I guess I wanted to challenge that and say that, in fact, there's different Jewish views, not just one perspective on Israel and Palestine.
In your book, you mentioned that, in a sense, it distanced you from your parents at the start, but then eventually brought you closer to your parents. Certainly some of your other relatives have a bit of trouble with the things you're saying and the things you're writing.
Yes, you might say that. My parents, I'm an only child, and my parents certainly these days are, you know, supportive of most things I write, not everything, of course, but my extended family, both in Australia and overseas, do have a problem with this. And what's fascinating is that these are not people necessarily at all who are living in Israel, who necessarily have any great knowledge about the issue, but it's almost as if in some kind of tribal way, we're expected to support Israel. And the result and the effect of that, I think, has been devastating, because you see in countless examples when Israel occupies the Palestinians, has been doing for many, many decades, commits war crimes on a daily basis by occupying both Palestinians, but also defending and supporting the settler movement. For listeners who don't know, there's over 500,000 Jewish settlers living illegally in the West Bank in Palestine. They've been there for over four decades. And the result of that, which ties into the UN vote which you mentioned before, in my view and many people's view, is that a two-state solution is not going to happen anymore. It's over. It's done. And that reality is something that I think many Jewish people, and indeed many people in general, including our own government here, the Gillard government, haven't really come to terms with. So being critical of Israel generally results, often within both Jewish families and also a general community, massive controversy, but also attack. I get hate mail and death threats simply for speaking out and being critical, mostly from other Jewish people, sadly. And the default position, I think, over many decades has been, as I said, almost a blind tribalism towards our own, as opposed to being critical to what's happening over there.
All right, well, look, we should get some of the language clear, first of all, and get you to explain. I'll ask you a couple of tough questions first.
Sure.
Israel, is Israel a democracy? Because we hear a lot that it is purported. It's said to be one of the, well, if not the only democracy in the Middle East, sometimes we hear.
Yeah.
In your belief, is Israel a democracy?
Israel calls itself the only democracy in the region. My view is that's not the case, principally because if you're Jewish, it's a democracy. Israel is claimed to be a secular democracy that benefits all citizens, but Israel occupies at least 5 million Palestinians in the West Bank, and indeed, in my view, and many people's view, never left Gaza in 2005 either. So, yes, if you are a Jew, you're a democracy living in Israel. If you are an Israeli Arab in Israel, your rights are far more than if you're an Arab in Saudi Arabia or Bahrain or other countries. That's certainly true.
Okay.
But the truth is that, yes, if you're a Palestinian under occupation, which is still Israel, it's not. So I think that tag is very questionable. And just finally, quickly, that of course is why many Israelis are scared of the Arab Spring, because it's almost as if the brand name is being challenged. Other countries can now also claim to be democracy too.
When you say the Arab Spring, what do you mean by that?
I mean what's been happening in the Middle East in the last 9 months. So the changes in Egypt, in Libya, in Tunisia. These countries have been transitioned. No one's suggesting otherwise. But dictatorships that were supported by decades by us being the West, are being challenged, and we're moving towards some kind of more equitable democratic process. No one quite knows what, no one quite knows the end point, but the idea somehow that other nations could have free elections, free democracy, is something I think that many in the Israeli government don't like, because, as many have argued for a long time, including me, the only way that Israel can survive in the long run is with dictatorships, not democracies. And I say that just briefly, because to maintain an occupation for years, you need countries like Egypt and Jordan and others to support you uncritically. If you have democracies, the people in those countries themselves, Egyptians, Jordanians, have shown time and time again, and in fact they fundamentally oppose what Israel is doing. So the will of the people in fact threatens what Israel is about, and that's something I think that Israel is very aware of.
And what's the population of Israel?
Jews, there's close to 6 million. And there are 20% Israeli Arabs. And in the West Bank and Gaza, there's roughly the same numbers of people, roughly. So
you're talking about the whole area, really? Well, Israel being the occupied Palestine as well.
Yes, I mean, clearly, as I said, Israel, if you're talking about how many Jews there are, there's close to 6 million, 6 or 7 million.
And non-Jews?
20% is about a million Israeli Arabs within Israel proper itself, and in the West Bank there's roughly three to four, and in Gaza, Palestinians of course, and Gaza about 1.5 million Palestinians.
All right, so look, the in Israel itself, everybody gets a vote, whether you're a Jew or an Arab Israeli, you still get a vote. That's correct, yep.
You do.
And so you would have to say then the government are democratically elected.
If the illusion of saying that there are Israeli Arab members of the Knesset, which is the parliament, then yes, on the surface, indeed. As I said, no one's comparing it to someone like Saudi Arabia or otherwise.
Yeah.
However, this is a very important point. The rights that Israeli Arabs have within Israel, despite being a so-called democracy, are much less. The resources, the ability to access schools, education, healthcare, is far, far less. The ability for Israeli Arabs to have full speaking rights is much less. There are increasing laws that the Israeli Knesset, the parliament, obviously run by predominantly Jewish people, are restricting free speech. So yes, on the face of it, yes, but many citizens, I think, within Israel and globally are aware that many Jews within Israel, particularly in the parliament, are increasingly keen to tag Israel as a Jewish state, meaning that if you're not Jewish, your rights are far less than if you are.
All right. Now, I'll ask you questions about Palestine as well. Is Palestine, or it's not a country, but the area of Palestine, is they have elections. Is that a democracy?
Well, I would argue no. In very, very brief summary, Gaza is run by Hamas, which is an Islamic political movement, won an election in 2006.
They are a democratically elected organisation.
I mean, I have major issues with the way Hamas operates, but ultimately they are democratically elected. They won an election in 2006, a free and fair election. The West didn't accept that and has essentially isolated Gaza ever since. In the West Bank, the territory is controlled by the Palestinian Authority. They're the organisation that went to the UN recently to ask for statehood. But there is a split between the West Bank and Gaza, exacerbated and supported by the West. including Australia. Because for us in the West, Hamas is seen as a terrorist organization, the Palestinian Authority is not. And what's happening in the West Bank is that you have a classic colonial situation where we are funding, arming, training, supporting a political party to almost manage the occupation for us. And we don't like Hamas because they are seen as being violent, they're Islamists, they are seen as anti-democratic. And there's no doubt that Gaza in the last years is under great difficulty politically. That is principally, though, because of a siege that's been imposed by Israel and Egypt. So is Palestine democratic? Not really. And that, of course, is something that Israel is very happy about because democracy may well bring parties that Israel doesn't like.
Mm-hmm. Now, I have to ask you about the secular nature of government. You're an atheist, a self-avowed atheist. Is there any room in any government, really, whether it's Israel, Palestine or Australia, for that matter, to have connections with religion?
Do you mean is it acceptable or should it be acceptable?
Well, should it be? Is it unhealthy to not to have separation between religious groups and government?
I think I'm coming from a position which believes in the separation between church and state. Israel certainly, on the one hand, on paper, can be claimed to be a secular democracy. However, this is very important, increasingly what's happened, particularly in the last 40 years since the occupation of Palestine started in 1967, has been a massive increase in power of religious fundamentalism. And, for example, the Prime Minister of Israel, Avigdor Lieberman, is a settler who lives illegally in the West Bank. He believes in the benefits of Jews above others. You have many pro-settler figures in the Israeli parliament. This is fundamentally at odds with the current democratic system. And you've seen, particularly in the last two or three years, under the government of Benjamin Netanyahu, who's the Prime Minister of Israel, who is relatively secular personally, and many Israeli Jews are secular. But what you've seen in the Knesset, in the parliament, is an imbalance and massive support for a more right-wing, hardline Jewish fundamentalism, which supports and defends settlements in the West Bank, which many of whom are religious. So, to me, there's a real blindness, I think, and ignoring in much of the West, including in our own government, saying that Israel's a democracy and we should support Israel. Well, if you support the idea of a Jewish exclusive state, then yes, and I think we in Australia and many other countries need to be aware of the fact that the louder and loudest voices within Israel are not secular, they're religious, and they have much power, and they believe exclusively in a state that discriminates against non-Jews.
Now, you talk about the settlers. There's been Barack Obama mentioned that he'd like to see a stop to the settlements. A lot of people have, but they still continue to go. And there was even a court case recently, I think, that claimed that they had to abandon some of the settlement houses, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes.
But they don't look like they're holding back at all. They still continue to build houses and to settle in areas that really occupied Israel, occupied Palestine.
Well, this is in some ways a remarkable part of this conflict, that you've seen for decades successive US presidents, successive Republican, Democrat, including Obama, Bill Clinton, George Bush, the list goes on, calling in speeches or in other forums the end of the settlements. But, most importantly, nothing changes. This is for a few different reasons, briefly. One is a very powerful Israel lobby in America that puts pressure on any US government to continue the settlements. Secondly, you have an Israeli government that is fundamentally supported by America and couldn't survive without it, and yet at the same time almost behaves without any kind of concern of American criticism. Obama, in many ways, actually has been a disaster for the conflict, because when he came into power, he did give some speeches talking about the settlements should end. But if, for example, you saw people listen to the Obama speech at the UN 2 weeks ago, the occupation doesn't really exist in his mind. It's not articulated. And the tragic reality for those who support Israel uncritically is that by continuing to expand settlements when you have over 500,000 people, people just briefly may imagine, oh, settlements, people living instead of homes in the West Bank. We have to understand, people are living in homes overlooking Palestinian villages illegally, often stealing land. There's regular cases, including again this week, of fundamentalist Jews leading pogroms against Arabs, mosques being burnt. This is not all settlers, but many of them. And the sad, tragic irony is that by continuing settlements, they're making a two-state solution impossible. Where is it going to be? You can't simply divide the land when there's no when settlements continue to expand. So I think what the Australian government and many other governments and many people around the world need to recognise is that by not criticising or condemning more strongly, saying unless settlements stop, our support for Israel will stop.
And when you're saying support, I mean, we're talking a lot of money that US gives Israel in aid. Is it $3 billion a year?
It's roughly $3 billion. It's the exact figure.
Mostly military.
Indeed.
Look,
Israel is the highest recipient of US aid annually. And it's anywhere between $3 to $9 billion. There's financial aid and military aid. And the analogy often that people make, and I think it's a very apt one, is like a drug pusher and the drug user, that someone who is addicted, Israel I'm talking about here, to expanding settlements illegally. If there was a responsible government, they would stop and say, unless you actually cease this behaviour, we're not going to keep feeding your addiction. And America, tragically, is continuing to do that. The result, though, as I said, is that in the long run, in my view and many other people's views, a Jewish state will not survive simply because there is a mad addiction to colonies. And more tragically, the only way that many of us believe Israel can survive is for two ways. One, there is indefinite ethnic cleansing or apartheid, and apartheid is not just a pejorative term, it's a legally recognised term which says that a minority racial group rules over a majority, which is basically what's happening or moving towards to be increasing. All is a one-state solution, which is a binational state, which is what I support and many others, which is a state like many other states in the world where people live equally. And yes, in time, Jews would be the minority, and there obviously needs to be... I've always argued that Jews have the right to live there. However, not discriminating against Palestinians or anybody else. And that's essentially where this conflict is now going.
So you'd like to see the whole area, basically, people living together, one state that's... democratically elected, and the government, I suppose, represents the demographic of the population by having both Jewish and Arab or Christian or whoever they are, within the government.
Indeed. Look, there's no doubt that in the mainstream discourses we hear all the time, all we hear is about a two-state solution. One-state solution is generally ignored or shunned or criticised because people say that's the end of the Jewish state. And my response to that, and many other people's increasingly response, is, well, if we believe actually in democracy, which is one person, one vote, a Jewish state by definition can't survive. And I say this equally, not just against Jewish states, but Muslim states as well. I mean, the inherent belief of a Christian state or a Muslim state is going to be discrimination against other people. And as I said, ultimately, when one sees what's happening inside Israel, it's almost a growing hysteria towards the demographics. And the demographics show within a point, we don't know when, but soon, Jews are a minority in their own country. And that, as I said, by definition means apartheid. So it always astounds me and saddens me that many, many Jews in the diaspora and indeed elsewhere, I think, realise this but have their head in the sand. And the Western governments are indulging that by continuing to support Israel uncritically.
Now, I want to ask you about Zionism and what exactly it is, because it's a bit confusing in a sense to someone to a non-Jewish person, because the actual definition of Zionism and the principles of Zionism, I believe, have changed quite a bit over the years. And there's different types of Zionists, because there's obviously Jewish Zionists, but there's also Christian Zionists. I'd just like to get a connection on those two for you. And also there's something you mentioned in the book called Messianic Zionists.
Let me summarise briefly. In its simplest form, I guess Zionism means self-determination of a Jewish people. Zionism is a belief that essentially started being articulated in the late 1800s. With less than 50 years, there was a Jewish state, obviously formed in the late 1940s in the ashes of the Holocaust, you might undoubtedly say. And that Zionism was generally secular. It was, in my view, quite racist towards non-Jews, but it was generally secular. Fast forward to 1967, there was a six-day war, there was an occupation which began, which has continued to this day, and a more fundamentalist Jewish settlement belief, and Zionism, which essentially says, we as Jews have the right to colonize land that was given to us by God, whether it's around Jerusalem or in the West Bank or in Gaza. Christian fundamentalism, Zionist fundamentalism, which is connected, is also believes that Jews have the right to colonize Palestinian land. However, and this ties into Messianic Zionism, is the belief of the rapture and the second coming. Namely,
this is what people
quite openly, like Sarah Palin, for example, believe in. It's not hidden. She acknowledges and talks about
and
it.
And George W. Bush as well. That be
and Bush in many ways does too. I would argue someone like Sarah Palin in a far more extreme way. Yep. But yes, what the Bush administration or elements of the Bush administration were saying is that we'll support Israel uncritically, but the end point is not to have a Jewish state, it's to believe in the second coming of Christ. And when Christ returns, they will kill anyone who's not Jewish. In other words, only those who believe in Christ will actually be saved, namely non-Jews. So you have this weird fusion in America, and indeed in parts of Europe, of Christian Zionist fundamentalists who support Israel uncritically, who say we must support Israel because it's God-given right for Jews to have that land. However, their end point is not a Jewish state, and it seems to me unbelievably short-sighted to have Jewish Zionists and Christian Zionists working together, because their ultimate goal and stake is very much different.
It seems incredible. Does it scare you? Does it scare you that someone like Sarah Palin may actually get a voice in the American political system?
Well, yes. I mean, to the extent that in my darker moments, in fact, I would often argue that people like Palin represent a very strong part of American society, whether she's going to become president. I mean, she hasn't declared she's going to run yet next year in the U.S. elections, but what's happening now on the Republican side in America, pretty much all the leading candidates, and of course we don't know who's going to be running against Barack Obama, have a certainly Christian Zionist perspective, a belief in almost an uncritical American perspective towards Israel. So it's not so much am I upset that they have a voice. I don't like what they're saying, but I think that it's important that they're heard, mainly because it surely should show these are individuals we shouldn't forget that years ago often would have been anti-Semitic. These are people years ago who, I'm not saying Sarah Palin per se, but individuals who would years ago not have liked Jews that much, and it's strong
conservative Christians, I suppose you're saying.
Absolutely. Yep. And there's been a shift of that in the last sort of 20, 30, 40 years, which has continued and been deepened by the Republican Party, particularly in America, and in parts of the far right in Europe as well, to fuse blind support for Israel and a belief in someone who longs for the second coming of Christ. You would think, on the face of it, utterly diametrically opposed views. And yet, in the short-term opportunism of this conflict, it's seen somehow that supporting Israel is the best policy. What upsets me is that you have too many Jews who don't recognize that or choose to ignore that, because ultimately that's going to be a very ugly divorce.
It is when it comes. That is, of course, if the world doesn't end first, Anthony.
Indeed.
We're talking to Anthony Lowenstein this morning, who's a journalist, a blogger, and he's author of a book called My Israel Question. If you'd like to join the discussion, 1-300-800-222, the text number 0437 774 774. I'd love to hear from you. Where do you think Australia should support a Palestinian bid for statehood? I'll just quickly ask you, Anthony, if the vote went before the UN next week and it looked like a two-party solution was possible or could practically happen, would you back off from your view of a one-state solution because, you know, as you said, you're only thinking that way because you can't see that a two-party solution is ever going to work? If it did go before the UN vote and the UN recognised a vote that Palestinians should be granted statehood, would that change your view on whether there should be a one-party or a two-party solution?
Look, the short answer is that many have argued, even those who support a one-state solution, such as myself, that you must start off with two-state and then move towards one, that the practical reality of simply establishing a one-state solution is too great. I would argue, in fact, the opposite. If you ask me if it goes before the UN, what should Australia do? Should we vote for it or against it. A ploy on the face, I would say we should support it rather than being against it. I mean, the Australian government position hasn't been articulated. We don't know exactly what the Gillard government would do. Mm. In all likelihood, it would either abstain or vote against it. There is no chance in hell we're going to vote for it. And that's mainly because, sadly, on this issue, for many, many years, our foreign policy is dictated by Washington rather than here. So there's been stories in the press in the last months that Kevin Rudd has advocated abstaining, mainly because there is a move by him and others to get on the UN Security Council to get a position. And there's no doubt that because the vast bulk of the world will support a Palestinian state. An Australian position is very isolated. In fact, people often in Australia don't realise that when we have votes in the UN on this issue in the last 10 years, both during the Howard years and during the Gillard-Rudd years, it literally is most of the world against Israel, Australia, America, Palau, Micronesia and the Marshall Islands. Now, most of those countries are client states of the US, and I often ask, so what's our excuse? And there is almost a default position here. So my point is not so much that a two-state solution is not viable, and that's why I'm against it. I think it's also a question of it almost demands a two-state solution, that 20% of Israeli Arabs within Israel must accept a Jewish state and be discriminated against because of that. I think that's fundamentally wrong.
I could go and asking you questions all morning. I found that that's a fascinating topic. Look, we better take some calls because we've got a board full here. So good morning, Ken.
Good morning, Pav.
All right, there. What did you want to say?
I'm wondering if the problem isn't that Israel has nobody with any power to actually talk to, no one to discuss or negotiate with. If they turned the Palestinian area, what's called the Palestinian area, back over to the Jordanians, which the Kingdom of Jordan, which is where it came from in the first place, they could actually negotiate some kind of deal with the Kingdom of Jordan as opposed to someone who is determined to destroy them, which obviously they're not going to negotiate with at all.
Yeah, this was an argument that was put forward early on in the establishment of Israel, Anthony, that that the neighbouring Arab countries should take responsibility for the Palestinian refugees and the Palestinians that may be displaced.
Yes. Look, there's no question that if one looks at the history since 1948 of the Arab states towards Palestinians, they've behaved unbelievably badly. There are in the Middle East millions of Palestinian refugees, particularly in places like Jordan and Lebanon, who are treated appallingly within those states. There's no question about that. However, this argument that's made, including by some within Israel, including some on the far right in Israel, is that somehow Jordan and Egypt should reclaim or take over responsibility for the West Bank or Gaza, ignores the fact that Palestinians who are living there in both those areas don't have a desire to be living under Jordanian or Egyptian rule, and more importantly, they shouldn't be. I mean, Israel occupies these territories illegally under international law, and indeed many of the settlements are illegal under Israeli law. So there is a sense, I think, that of your caller who's saying that why would Israel negotiate people who want them to be destroyed? I would argue that's not the point. Are there some who hate Israel and Jews? Absolutely correct, for sure, undoubtedly so. But there has been a consistent message for years from the Palestinians, we will talk to you, we will talk to you. And even during the Oslo years in the 1990s, when there was a sense that we're moving towards some kind of peace, the truth is settlements doubled in size. They doubled in size during that point. So if one talks about saying the other side is not serious, Israel can say that as long as they want. But the truth is, the longer they don't find some resolution, their chance of existing as a Jewish state disappears, because on a numbers game, Israel will not win that battle.
And this is that's the same time when Rabin was assassinated too, wasn't it?
Absolutely. And of course, one of the great myths of this conflict is that Rabin was the great peacemaker. In fact, when he was prime minister, although, yes, there were negotiations between Yasser Arafat, Bill Clinton at the time, and himself and the Israeli government, settlements were massively expanding. In fact, they doubled. So many Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza were saying to themselves, well, we're supposedly undergoing a peace process, allegedly, and yet we're seeing what's happening. And this, I think, ties in very much to what's happened with the UN statehood bid, that for decades now, two decades, the Palestinians have been saying, we've been negotiating, I would argue not very successfully, and all we've seen are now over 500,000 Jewish settlers in the West Bank, let alone what's happening in Gaza. So ultimately, what the Palestinian Authority has been saying is, we're going to the UN because we have no faith in negotiations. And I think one of the things that listeners should be aware of, whenever we hear the concept of a peace process, we should be aware there is no peace process. A peace process is only a term that's used to justify and defend continued occupation of Palestine. So it's like a fig leaf. It's almost like saying the impression is, oh, it's a peace process, we should just go back to the negotiating table. Palestinians have done that for two decades, and the result of that has only been settlements have expanded. So people should be very sceptical when they hear that term in the media.
You've mentioned before about some of the settlements, and most of the settlements are illegal under Israeli law.
Mm.
But the Israeli court's toothless or something. How come the law isn't enforced?
Well, again, a complex question, but in summary, there are cases where the top court in Israel fines against settlements, often it's not enforced. Sometimes it's enforced. Sometimes you have a situation where the Israeli military establishment within the West Bank has been so effectively infiltrated by settlers. This is both often within the military itself, that, and I spent a lot of time in the West Bank myself, and often you see this. You have violent Jewish settlers who are attacking Palestinians, burning down their olive groves, burning down their homes, attacking them, burning down mosques, which happened again this week. And the army, the IDF, Israeli Defense Force, whose task you would think would be to support Palestinians against Jewish violence, in fact, sides with the settlers. And that's because in the last decades, military rule occupies or operates in that territory. And there is a sense, I think, that you've had almost like a wink-wink, nudge-nudge view across the political spectrum in Israel. This is both from the so-called left and the so-called right. In fact, during the supposed more progressive political periods in history, during including Rabin, the 1990s, settlements, in fact, expand more. So you really have almost a consensus. And of course, there are Israelis who are opposed to this, and I have these Israeli Jewish friends who are utterly opposed to the settlements, but they have no political power at all. And so the Israeli courts often are not just toothless, in fact, they enable that dual military-civilian rule to continue.
Let's have a chat to Kevin. Good morning, Kevin.
Morning. I support the concept that the UN vote in the General Assembly should be overwhelming here, and it will be, to establish the state we talk of, your man there's talking about. In 1948, Australia took an integral part of establishing the Jewish state in the United Nations. Dr. Evatt was pushed the thing and pushed it. But I don't think ever envisaged the state we're in now. I believe that the Netanyahu government is absolutely terrified of the vote in the UN, and the only way that they can stop the state from being established by the UN is that the Americans will intervene. And once again, they will support Israel, and justice will not be done.
Good on you, Kevin. Thank you. Some of the founding fathers of Israel are a lot more moderate, you'd have to say, than some of the ones that we're left with. Even someone like Einstein, I believe, had some reservations about starting a state of Israel or a Jewish state.
Well, Einstein, indeed. I mean, Einstein's a fascinating case. I mean, Einstein was profoundly worried about the concept of a Jewish state. And in fact, there's actually a new book that's just out this month, funnily enough, in the States, which talks very much about Einstein. Einstein advocated a one-state solution, believing very presciently, of course, you could never predict what was going to happen, but imagine this could happen, that a Jewish exclusive state would only lead to tears. And if you say, as you just did, the leaders initially were more moderate, we shouldn't forget that Israeli historians particularly have actually exposed the fact in the last 20 years that in 1948 there was ethnic cleansing of up to 750,000 Palestinians who were forcibly removed from their lands for the establishment of Israel. The ashes of the Holocaust, etc. It was almost as if, as the rule of Britain declined in the world and America took over, so to speak, as we still are in 2011, that the rights of Jews were seen as more important because of what happened to us during the Second World War. But, yes, there's no doubt that a Jewish fundamentalist element in the West Bank wasn't really around 60 years ago. And I think many in the West, including particularly in the Jewish diaspora, choose to blindly ignore that or willfully ignore that, almost because they cling on to in my view, a delusion about what happened in the Holocaust. The Holocaust was an undeniably devastating event for humanity, Jews, etc. Undoubtedly the case. But You know, the result is that here we are 60-odd years on, and Israel has become a state that discriminates against Arabs almost in a way to insulate themselves from criticism because of what happened during the Holocaust.
Now, we've only got about a minute to the news, Anthony, so I'll just quickly take a comment from Michael. G'day, Michael.
Hey there. All I was going to say was there's no point in... Australia is irrelevant in the equation. The most important countries are countries that have hold veto, the United States, Russia and China, and until you can get even the United States on board, there will not be a two-state solution. And wasn't there actually like a one state in 1910 before in 1920 there was all this talk about a Zionist state?
Anthony?
In short term, there was a quasi, they were living together, sometimes harmoniously, sometimes not. But yes, in many ways, yes, I would argue that. And I think on a numbers game and a political game and a moral game, that's actually where we're going again.
Now, I'm sorry for all those people who are online there waiting to go on air. It's just been too fascinating to squeeze too many calls in. Look, I did enjoy your book, Anthony. It's very interesting.
Thank you so much.
It's very clearly written and... it gives you a lot of background on a very troubled conflict that's been happening for a long time. So thank you very much for your time on the program this morning.
I appreciate it's been great the opportunity. Thank you.
Cheers.
Thank
that's
you.
Anthony Lowenstein, who's a journalist, blogger and author of My Israel Question on ABC Local Radio.